You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
You're listening to Muses and Stuff, the podcast that celebrates those who live, love, and breathe rock and roll. From the incredible groupies, girlfriends, and wives who went after what and who they wanted, to the journalists, photographers, and other behind-the-scenes characters who play such an important part in rock and roll history. We are your hosts, Shanti and Lynx. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Electrified Porcupine,
bringing you the best in collectibles, movies, music, wrestling, gaming, and more. Check it out at electrifiedporcupine.com.
Hey there, this is Christian Swain from the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Rock and Roll Archaeology? What's that you say? We are a podcast network dedicated to digging deep into the amazing music that exploded out of the second half of the 20th century. We believe the music, culture, and technology wove together, and it is an important story of history as, say, the Italian Renaissance or the Impressionists of Paris. We have 6 shows, all with a different side of this incredible time. Rock Talk with myself and host Peter Farioli. Real Rock, and that's R-E-E-L, hosted by Andy King. Vinyl Snob with the legendary Dave Whitaker. Rock and Roll Librarian with the headmistress herself, Shelley Sorensen. Deeper Digs in Rock, where I interview famous rock and roll personalities and the people who scribed the times and events. And finally, our full telling of the history of rock and roll, the Rock and Roll Archaeology Podcast, which started it all. Find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts. So let's get back to Between the Sheets of Rock and Roll with Shanti and Lynx. And Muses and Stuff.
Hi, Lynx.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. So good.
So happy that you're here.
I'm happy to be here.
And I'm excited about this one.
You're always excited.
I am. I am, so. Especially about ones I know nothing about, and this is definitely one of those. So,
well, thank you for sending me this book. You are so good at finding these women, and you are you're a friggin' hero. So, you actually directed me to the book and the woman and the episode that I'm going to be telling you today.
Yeah, this is exciting.
Mm-hmm. You know what else is exciting?
What?
I'm going to New York this weekend.
I'm so jealous. I so wish I could be going with you.
It's my first time, and so expect lots of Instagram stories.
Yeah.
I'm going vintage shopping.
Yeah.
I'm going to
just walk around.
You got to tell me some of the places you're going.
Yeah, I will. I'll show you my itinerary after.
Yeah. I got some vintage shops that you might be into.
Okay. Perfect.
Cool.
And for our lovely listeners who are listening in real time, as they call it, happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is kind of special, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we like to talk about love all of the time, every episode, every day. But that's, yeah. Happy Love Day. So.
Yes.
Today, I'm going to tell you about a woman named Pauline Butcher.
Yes.
And she has a book called Freak Out, My Life with Frank Zappa.
Perfect title.
Isn't it?
Perfect title.
So, my mom really liked Frank Zappa.
Ooh.
So I remember her mentioning that. And then when I was going to type up the episode, I was like, I'm going to ask her exactly what about Frank Zappa, especially learning more about him, watching his thing on Netflix, and then reading this book. It's like, my mom?
Yeah.
Yeah? So I called her and I was just like, what did you like about Frank Zappa and the Mother's Invention?
Mm-hmm.
And she said because it came out at this time, the age that she was in her second year of college. It was the summer of her second year of college. And she said that it just made a lot of sense to her.
Interesting.
When a lot of people, I think, would say that it's nonsense.
It's the opposite.
It made sense to her. And then she said that, like, a lot of people really didn't like them, but they were people who were narrow-minded and wouldn't give him a chance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That does make sense in a way that, you know, a certain age group, when you're especially like that age group, you're wanting to discover more, you know, what's out there. And that is a perfect time to kind of get into Zappa. I think something really special about him, too, is that he really did surround himself with women.
Oh, my. Did he ever? And let me tell you about them.
Yeah. That I'm sure has a lot to do with his character, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if you're wondering who Pauline Butcher is, mm-hmm. well, she was a young secretary who grew up in England. And it was in 1967 that her life changed. So her job consisted of, like, typing menus, adverts, film scripts, novels for, like, hopeful writers.
Mm-hmm.
And so her and, like, a bunch of other girls, they would run around town with, like, portable typewriters or notebooks, and they would travel to hotel rooms or private homes. And she said that they had some clientele that were important people indeed.
Mm-hmm.
So she was the 10th child of 11.
Wow.
And she said that she was, like, a more submissive child, not really causing too much trouble. She felt that because her mother, you know, provided her with food, did her laundry, gave her a home, and she only paid a little bit of rent, that, like, she didn't want to rustle any feathers. So she had three older sisters who were still at home with her.
Mm-hmm.
And this would... Or, sorry, she had three sisters who, by the time she came to the U.S.,
yeah.
were already living in the United States.
Okay.
Yes. And this would prove, like, really convenient for her later on.
For sure.
Her father was a retired carpenter who she says would bring her cups of tea in bed. Mm. He supported all of his 11 children, and she kept this from him. She never told him this, but when she was a secretary, she actually made more in a week than he did in a month.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So what she also did, besides being the secretary, is that she would do some, like, catwalk work, and she also worked, like, teaching young girls how to be models, how to walk, how to pose, how to do these kinds of
cool.
things. She was, like, teaching modeling. And so she said, like, she would run around town sometimes, like, working all three jobs in one day. Which, like, kind of makes me feel like what I've been doing. So I was really identifying with her a lot during this.
It's cool, too, because it's, like, one half professional, one half kind of artist. And
Yeah. So, yeah, she said that she made more in a week than he did in a month from simply prancing up and down a catwalk and bashing a typewriter. She drove a Mini. And I read in an article, it's like an article in The Guardian, she was described as wearing Minis and driving a Mini. And nice. So this Mini was her joy. One day she was at the office and nobody was picking up the phone. I think the person that was actually supposed to like pick up the phone and then tell the girls where they were going like wasn't in. So she picked up the phone.
Cool.
And it's a good thing she did because there was a job. To go to a hotel room. And she asked all of the girls, does anybody want this job? Nobody wanted it. So she said, okay, Pauline Butcher will be there. And the person on the other end said, it's for Mr. Zappa, room 412.
Wow.
Yeah. So she had always wanted to be a journalist. So being a typist made her feel like she had missed her calling and that she had lost her chance to become a writer. When she was only 22, she met this man, a journalist, at a party, and he told her that she was too late. So what? Like journalists, like they start when they're 16. And so basically her dream was squashed.
It's never too late.
Well, I think that's very true. Journalism was her dream job, and although she wasn't unhappy, her life wasn't as exciting as she thought that it would be. Until, of course,
yes.
She met Frank Zappa.
Talk about exciting.
She hadn't found a guy that she was crazy about. You know, 22, England, yeah. Like, at this point, like, in the 60s, like, girls... we're starting to settle down. Instead, she decided to save all of her money and travel. She had this pension, like I said, for wearing very short skirts. And when it was time to go up to the hotel to meet this mysterious Mr. Zappa, there was a man in an elevator flirting with her and said, wow, even in California, girls don't wear skirts that short. And she said that she was ready to flirt and replied, well, this is London. In fashion, we lead the world.
Damn straight.
Yeah, he ended up actually going to Frank's hotel room as well. And then that began her introduction to the wacky world of rock and roll. So Frank was in England at this time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
So she thought that she had the wrong room when he opened the door. because like many people who would just see Frank Zappa, nobody took him seriously. But really, he was one of the most serious men in the whole world.
Yeah.
So what she was doing there was Frank wanted her to type up the lyrics on a tape that he had, and he wanted them by the next day. One of the guys in the hotel room said to Pauline, this guy is a musical genius. Stick by him and you'll go far.
Wise words.
Mm-hmm. Pauline describes Frank's appearance and says that he looked like no other living creature I'd seen. She says that he was oddly handsome and that no one had ever listened so closely and so attentively to her before. She was pretty prim and proper and never, ever swore. So coming into this room and like listening to those tapes was like a complete shock to her. Of the tape that she listened to, she says, I pressed the play button and gobbledygook burst out. As he disappeared through the door, I called out, Mr. Zappa. He stepped backwards. Uh-huh. Is this English? He curled one side of his mouth in a wry smile. Pleased that he understood my humor, I smiled back cheekily. He gave me one last cool appraisal and then vanished to join the others. I stared after him, wanting him to stay and talk more.
Aww.
Yeah. She's got some really interesting stories. Like, for example, one night, one of her modeling friends asked her to accompany her and a director and his two friends to the Dorchester Hotel, where she ate the best steak she'd ever tasted. She said that they were all talking about the movie Blow Up and, like, none of them understood it at all. She tried to explain to them about the symbolism and they just, like, grumbled at her. And when she realized, like, oh, I'm just here to be, like, a pretty face and just shut up.
Blow Up, such a good film.
Yeah. So after, because she was talking about the symbolism and just like how, like
there's
what it was
so
representing.
Much there.
And they were just like,
yeah.
So after dinner, no surprise, the men pretty much told the girls to go to the bedroom and like, okay, time for this part. And Pauline's just like, what?
No.
No. And so she pretty much grabbed her friend and like got her out of there. And her friend ended up crying and saying, oh, Pauline, they promised me a part in their film. Now you've ruined it.
No.
Yeah.
No.
So back to Frank. The next day, she brought the typed lyrics to him and was so excited. She says that she almost jumped in front of the taxi, like, to get there. When he read her lyrics, he laughed and said that what she typed was even better than the original. So I'm going to quote. Feeling a little encouraged, I said, I didn't understand a lot of it, so I made it up. A baby doll makes a filthy poo? What should it be? A case of airplane glue. See, what she wasn't sure what kind of audience this appealed to, so Frank had to explain to her that he had a niche market, and although radio stations refused to play them, he said, generally, we seem to thrive where there's dissent between generations because we tend to pep things up.
Mm.
She discussed his lyrics, basically called them immoral, and although she was kind of afraid that he'd kick her out, he patiently explained things to which she dictated, such as... So he said, take this down. He crossed his legs and leaned one elbow on his knee, his cigarette poised while he collected his thoughts. Presumably because of my puzzlement with some of the lyrics, he felt compelled to dictate an explanation for each of the tracks. Plastic people are the insincere assholes who run almost everybody's country. Vegetables are people who are inactive in a society and who do not live up to their responsibilities. The Duke of Prunes is a surrealistic love song, and the words prune me, cheese me, are transmuted from the basic fuck me, suck me till my eyes roll back, baby. Imagine how she must have felt, like, never even uttering these words before, and now all of a sudden she's writing them down.
Ugh.
So I'm going to continue. She writes, please. He raced on, clearly enjoying himself, hugging one bare foot over his knee. Brown Shoes Don't Make It is a song about the unfortunate people who manufacture inequitable laws and ordinances, perhaps unaware of the fact that the restrictions they place on the young people in society are the result of their own sexual frustrations. Dirty old men have no business running your country.
Amazing. I love that, like, it sounds like it's nonsense, but there's... so much thought put behind all those crazy words.
Yeah, and I love how my mom was apparently picking up on this stuff. Yeah. So after he read her typed lyrics, he corrected them. He invited her to go to a speakeasy. There was definitely sparks of energy between them, and she was very interested and very keen to spend more time with him. At the speakeasy, she describes boys with Beatles haircuts with Patti Boyd lookalikes. So I always knew that there were boys who were imitating the Beatles, but I totally forgot that there were probably so many girls imitating Patti Boyd as well.
Yeah.
So people were definitely staring at them, and some people were going like, hey, that's Frank Zappa. And so to be silly, they did a little dance all the way to their table. That night, Eric Clapton came up to Frank's tables, because it's not a Muses episode if we don't mention Eric Clapton somehow getting in here.
I just watched his documentary. It was so good.
What?
I think it was called like Life in 12 Bars or something.
Oh.
There's tons of Patti. Like, in their relationship, and it tons of it.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's really good.
How did you watch it?
On my TV.
But, like, you had it on, like,
it was on, like, a DVD, or was on TV? HBO or something. Amazing. Like that. Yeah.
Oh, that's, like, that's when I miss television.
It was good.
So that night, Eric went over to Frank's table because he was a big fan. Many people, many guys like that, they really respected Frank Zappa. And Pauline had no idea who he was, really, and asked, so what do you play? Yeah, she did have some interest in music. She did like the Beatles. She had seen the Animals and Jimi Hendrix, but she was pretty embarrassed. And she eventually went home hoping that she would see Frank again.
Mm-hmm.
She said that her work dragged on and her social life felt boring.
After you meet Zappa, everything must be boring.
No. She saw Frank on the cover of Melody Maker, and that's when he was in the floral dress with pigtails, or bunches, as she calls them. She was torn because she really wanted to see him again, but she didn't have the courage to call him directly and ask him if he had any more work for her. So when Frank and the Mothers of Invention played a show in her town, she bought a ticket.
Yay!
And so his show was a mix of comedy, rock and roll, jazz, orchestral music.
Oh, God, imagine seeing him live.
Enter Susie Cream Cheese.
Oh!
So... who is Susie Cream Cheese, you might ask?
Yeah.
Well, when asked by the press, is she your girlfriend or something? Frank answered, or something. She was a member of the band, and yeah, so Pauline saw her on stage and was like, wait, who is this woman, like, or this girl? You know, she's got long straight hair, she's pretty, was she one of Frank's lovers? Who was she? Well, we'll soon find out. After the show, Pauline did probably one of the biggest groupie things I've ever heard of.
Oh, God.
And went to the stage door around the building where she says a cluster of people waited. So she waited. She watched him sign autographs. And when he finally saw her, he was delighted to see her. He asked her if she had her mini with her, and she did. So they left together.
Yay.
Yeah.
I've done that many times.
Oh, good. I did it for the Hives.
Nice.
Yeah, I convinced my friend to do it, and we met a couple of the members. We didn't meet Helen Pelionkvist, but it worked because they were outside on the side of the stage smoking. And
I can't even name the amount of times I've done that in my teen years.
You know what? I don't think I ever had friends really bold enough to do that with me at bigger concerts, and I wasn't going to shows in Toronto.
I didn't really either until I started doing it and met friends like also doing it.
Oh, if only we would have been together.
I know.
Imagine all of the backstage doors we would have.
Oh my goodness.
Where was I? Susie Cream Cheese.
They got in the van.
Okay, so they went to a party where Susie Cream Cheese arrived with Jeff Beck and Ronnie Wood.
Amazing.
And she reintroduced them to Frank and then like made a beeline for Pauline. She was really curious. She was curious about Pauline.
Yeah.
Pauline was curious about her. So pretty much right away, she asked Pauline if her and Frank had had sex, but not quite in those words.
Yeah.
Like, it was kind of like, so did fishing you guys around. Fuck? That's exactly what it was. And Pauline kind of like snapped back, like kind of like, none of your business. And like, what? So what if we had, would you have been jealous? And so anyways. They didn't get off on like the best foot, but they ended up becoming friends as much as you can kind of become friends with. Well, I'll get to the drama and the log cabin and with Gail and everything. But Susie Cream Cheese was kind of like territorial over Frank in a way, and said she'd kind of like been there from the beginning and that she was the one that introduced Gail to Frank. And I don't think she was very happy that she'd gotten like a kind of second in line.
And I got you. And like, who's this new woman entering the picture?
I mean, honestly, like, I'm not even clear on if they did have a relationship or not. I wouldn't put it past them and for that to happen. But anyways, her name was Pam, and Pauline calls her Pams because her last name starts with a Z. I wrote it down somewhere. But the reason why she called her Pams instead of Pam was because there was another Pamela hanging around with the Zappas. Our girl, Pamela DeBar.
Amazing.
At the time, Pamela Miller, because at this time, Pamela was only 19.
Oh, wow, yeah.
But we're going to get into that.
We need to ask Miss P about her, too.
We do. We need to ask Miss P about Susie Cream Cheese and about Pauline Butcher.
Yeah.
Because wait until you hear about how much Pauline was involved with the GTOs.
Yeah, please.
Okay.
Oh, this keeps getting better.
Yeah. So eventually, Pauline and Frank left and went back to his hotel room. He asked her if she'd like to get high, to which she replied no, which was the right answer because, as we know, Frank was very, very against drugs.
Yeah.
He tried to get close to her on the bed, but she distanced them, and he asked her questions about her job and relationships, asking her if she got any nookie with her clients. Mm-hmm. He was always asking people about sex. Always, 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 always. They continued to chat, and Pauline says that Frank made her feel like she had worth. They talked until they were both exhausted, and he helped her with her coat and said that he had a great time.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. 4 months later, in January of 1968, she went to Washington to visit her sisters. They all had families there, and she knew that Frank lived in New York. So Herb, Frank's manager, I think he was, said that she could call whenever she was in town, and so she did. So Herb took her out to dinner and then would eventually bring her over to Frank's house. But during dinner, something happened that Pauline was not expecting. She got some insight into Frank's home life, which she didn't know about.
Oh, okay.
She didn't know
about Gail?
No. Wow. Frank had never mentioned it. She also didn't know that they had a child.
Wow.
So she says, I happily stabbed into my food, looking forward with even more anticipation to my forthcoming meeting with Frank, unaware that a pothole was waiting to swallow me up. Herb said, have you met Gail before? Gail? Frank's wife. I attempted not to change the expression on my face. They got married last September.
Aww.
Before their tour, I muttered. How odd, he never said. I searched my mind back to that night at the Royal Garden Hotel, trying to remember any mention, any hint of a wife. We talked about the band, the concert, Susie Cream Cheese, the war in Vietnam, but I would have remembered if he mentioned that he was married, news that would have stopped me in my tracks. Married men were just off my radar.
Wow. It's probably good she didn't know, because maybe she wouldn't have contacted them.
Oh, I never thought of it that way. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she went to Greenwich Village. Did I say that right?
Greenwich.
I better get it right before I actually go to New York. How come there's a W in there if it's...
It's just...
I'm not going to argue with it.
It's just there.
At least I'm not going to make the mistake of Greenwich, which I think I did in like one of the first three episodes of this podcast.
Greenwich.
I'm sorry. Okay, so that's where Frank and Gail lived. And it was actually Gail who opened the door for her. And I'm going to read to you what she said.
Please.
I'm Gail, she said and held out her hand. I took it and said formally, how do you do? She gave me a little smile, almost shy. She was extremely pretty, like Brigitte Bardot, minus the makeup. Her light brown hair tousled and uncombed. She wore tight jeans with a roll neck black jumper and bare feet. Come on in, she said. And so Gail made her a cup of tea. She was really confused. Why was she there? Why did he invite her? Gail sat by Frank's feet and eyed Pauline, and Pauline knew that this was the gaze of a woman that indicated that, like, Frank was hers.
Yeah.
Gail talked about English pop stars she had known, and when Pauline asked how she had met them, Gail said this, which I think is super cute and hilarious. You go to clubs and you stand there, and before you know it, Gary and the Pacemakers or Jimmy Page or Jeff Beck is standing next to you, you know? No.
Oh, yeah, I
know. No, I didn't know.
They're always just there.
Besides her stunning prettiness, Gail had a soft, unthreatening, almost bashful air. I could imagine boys scrambling over themselves to reach her. Tall and angular, I lacked that kind of appeal. If I stood around in a club, that's where I would stay for the rest of the evening, alone. Mm. Yeah. So Frank was very different here, as you can imagine.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
Distant and really into the music that they were listening to. And that's when she realized that when you're listening to music with Frank Zappa, you listen to the music and you don't talk.
Mm.
So she desperately wanted a few minutes alone with Frank and thought that when it was time to leave, that maybe he would walk her to the door. But it was Gail who walked her to the door and hailed her the cab. And Gail just kind of, when Pauline said, like, thanks for having me, Gail was kind of like, oh, you know, it's not a big deal. Frank always has people over, guys, girls, weirdos. So once again,
Gail's sort of like, this is my house.
And Pauline's bubble was kind of burst.
Yeah.
So she ended up, you know, leaving. So Pauline ended up staying in the States until April.
Wow.
Yeah. And just kind of hopping from one sister to another, she says, enjoying a life of leisure.
That's lovely.
Yeah. But Frank had given her his phone number that night. I guess he just, like, put it into her hand. And before she left the States, she called him because she figured, why give it to me if he didn't want?
Yeah.
Like, if you don't want me to use it. And so over the phone, Frank had mentioned that he wanted to write a book, like a political book, and offered Pauline the opportunity to type it up.
Perfect.
In California.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. So what a dream. You know, Hollywood, rock stars, writing, and a step closer to her ultimate goal.
Yeah.
So she saw Susie Cream Cheese again, whose full name was Pam Zabrubica. And she immediately told Pauline that she doesn't get along well with Gail, yada, yada, yada. There was like a lot of, there was at the beginning of the book, I actually wasn't sure if I was going to end up enjoying it because there was a lot of kind of bad talk about Gail, about Pam, about like the people, like just, she just really turned her nose up to a lot of people. And actually I talked to our doll Taylor.
Yeah.
Taylor interviewed Pauline.
I know.
And so I was halfway through the book and I was like, she just is talking shit all the time about everybody.
Yeah.
But she really comes around. Okay.
So she's talking about her first impressions, not, you know, what she's left with.
Like, there was apparently a lot of bickering and a lot of like cat fighting and a lot of like women kind of issues happening in the house. Like, I think it might have been like a dominance thing.
Yeah.
Honestly, like, if you get a bunch of women who are all pretty much like wanting to have some part in Frank's life
and they're all strong,
they're all strong women, like, you are gonna have some of that, like,
for sure. And also, like, you're all so young. I mean,
that's true.
If they were in their 30s, it would probably have come out differently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I left out a lot of the, like, kind of pettiness, the bickering. And
great.
But I'll keep in some of the things that I think are just, like, relevant.
Perfect.
Because their relationships were always warm and cool. Like, they'd be, like, she'd be best friends with Gail for a while. And then, they would be at each other about the jobs and her job especially. And
when you get, especially so many women together in one house, it's like, I can see how.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and mm-hmm. When you all are, like, idolizing this one man. And
yeah. So Frank did come on to Pauline again, like, tickling her, kissing her. And she really, really wanted the job. And she was actually worried that by, like, turning him down, that she would wound his ego. And this is, like, a really interesting part of the book where she does talk about that kind of stuff, about, like, about the men, about men and their ego. But anyways, to her delight, even though she didn't, because she's like, he's married and I'm no, so she did not ever
go there.
And he still, like, he gave her the job. He still wanted her to have the job. She was expecting a call, like, oh, sorry, actually, this book's not happening.
Like, he's not a creep. He's not like,
well, you'll get this job. That. Like, Frank Zappa, like, I love him. I do.
Yeah.
And I love what he did for the GTOs. I love what he did for women. But no, like, yeah, he was still a creep.
Still a creep. Okay.
So anyways, she got paid $70 a week and she was supplied with a room in his house. And was kind of promised, like, food as well, but Gail didn't prove to be much of a cook.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's when she moved into the log cabin in Laurel Canyon.
Yeah.
He told her it's in the hills overlooking Hollywood. It has 14 bedrooms, 7 bathrooms, and caves underneath that will turn into a recording studio. There's a swimming pool, and get this, it has a treehouse.
It's like a magic, like, playland.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
But actually, kind of like the Clapton Castle that we mentioned in a few episodes, like, it wasn't exactly what it seemed. Like, the idea of it is cool.
Yeah.
And it did have a fully working bowling alley underneath, but that was, like, the only, ironically, it was the only working thing in the house. Like, when she arrived, she was just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, it was, the walls were stained, there was no hot water. But when she first arrived, one of the first people that she met at the house was Christine.
Oh,
who would later become Miss Christine.
Yes,
because Christine is the babysitter. So I'll read you what she wrote. I'm Christine. I'm the babysitter. She giggled and offered me her limp wrist. Welcome to the log cabin. Tall and stick thin, her hair was a mass of frizz with silver paper and ribbons woven into it. She wore a see-through blouse that shadowed nipples on a flat, bony chest, a white frill fur skirt she'd tied at the waist with mauve chiffon, and bright pink tights. From her china doll face, large blue eyes stared as if she were blind. Mm-hmm. So people were always dropping by the log cabin. Strange looking people, either extremely ugly or very beautiful. So she was disappointed with the state of her room, black dirty marks on the walls, stains on the ceiling, and a standing lamp with no shade or bulb. So she had her work cut out for her. But she said the room was large and it did have, like, a few windows that of the view of the beautiful foliage.
Cool.
Yeah. At this time, Gail and Frank had little Moon Unit, who was just a little baby. And, like I said, she came to not rely on Gail for much, even going as far to say that Gail had three speeds: slow, very slow, and stop.
Okay.
Shortly after moving in, she was given a job to transcribe the tapes of a woman interviewing Frank about the influence of the 1950s on the present day rock scene. And she was kind of jealous because she wanted to be the one doing the interview, yeah, not typing it up. Meanwhile, she was meeting all of the other freaks. That's what they were called, the freaks who hung around. Calvin was one, and who lived up in the treehouse. He was really cute. He did, like, art design. He was kind of the artist around the house. He took photos. Christine's friend, Sandra.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So they're starting to be introduced, our girls. She wrote letters home, felt lots of mixed emotions living there, and took down Christine's story in shorthand at Frank's request. Christine talked about her look and said, "To other people, when they look at us, it looks like it all looks really nasty. But when you get right down to it, Pamela and Sparky are virgins. I'm hardly ever with boys, and Miss Lucy doesn't like to fuck. You see only scantily dressed little girls, but it's just not like that." Yeah.
Don't judge a book by its cover. Mm.
Other people who dropped by were Joni Mitchell, David Crosby, but she didn't really know who they were. Stephen Stills, Graham Nash, Mama Cass, Grace Slick.
All the Laurel Canyon regulars.
Yeah, and shout out to our doll Jacqueline, because the Monkees lived up the road.
Yes.
She said that once word got around that Frank Zappa had moved into the log cabin, the house filled with freaks, hippies, musicians, and groupies.
Nice.
So, of course, my favorite part of this book is whenever she talked about the GTOs, who actually weren't the GTOs yet.
Yeah.
At first, I wasn't thrilled about the way she talked about them, but she really came around and she really warmed up and she really grew to love them.
It's interesting, yeah, because she really was an outsider, this kind of stuffy British woman coming into this, you know, wild world.
She was the freak to them.
Yeah,
she was the
exactly
weirdo with, like, her done up hair yeah, and her, like, and her little
straight laced kind of attitudes.
Even though she had a short skirt, like, it always, like, matched. I'm sure it always looked great. Yeah. So apart from pop stars, there grew up around Frank's tolerant and non-judgmental presence as a group of weirdos and hangers-on, all poor in purse, all searching for a different life, the dropouts of society. Mm. I didn't hate them, but I certainly looked down my nose, superior and lofty. Mostly, they were Christine's ragamuffin friends, Sparky, Pamela, Sandra, and Lucy. Just as weird-looking as Christine, they each dressed in their own quirky way, wearing cobbled-together garments. A noisy, ragged bunch, they carried themselves with casual abandon and took pride in lounging about the kitchen, telling wild stories about their adventures in what sounded like a foreign language. Where it's at, gross, out of sight, groovy, hung up. Still, Frank obviously thought there was something genuine about them, and I knew I should try to be charitable and feel as he did. He never complained, even when he came back from interviews and they were practicing their dancing in the living room. Indeed, he positively preened in their presence. "We're your biggest fans, Mr. Zappa. We love you, Mr. Zappa. We would die for you, Mr. Zappa." Aww. And he would reply, "Why, you little vixens, you."
Aww.
Yeah.
Well, at least she admits, like, look, I was stuffy. I acted this way, and that she was, you know, realizing I need to be more open.
Yeah. She began attending concerts, and, you know, in true fashion of our episodes, she would stand on the side of the stage. She tells a pretty funny story about Eric Clapton coming up on stage and, like, with Frank and people not really caring about him. At this time, the girls would go on stage and dance. She thought that they were crude with their sexual overtones, but Gail loved them.
Of course.
She was proud and happy to be in the in crowd. And she said about Frank, with his nonchalance yet commanding manner on stage, there was no one else like him. Frank did not watch television or read newspapers. So when Pauline was living at the Canyon, neither did she.
Wow.
She began to spend more time with Pam's, going out to the Whiskey a Go-Go, socializing with pop stars. She says, "When Pam's was not preventing a very drunk Jim Morrison from falling between the tables, she and I and whoever chauffeured us would abandon the whiskey in favor of Barney's Beanery, an extraordinary hub of a place open 24 hours a day. Pauline enjoyed the company of English rock stars a bit more, who she says, whose conversation sparkled with really with witty retorts. None of the soul-searching, verging on neurotic self-analysis of the American boys.
Yeah, they were probably a little more reserved as well. And yeah, I can see that.
So as she was getting closer to Pam's, Pam's was talking a lot of shit about Gail and even Frank as a father, which I like left out.
Yeah.
You know, like that was my least favorite part of the book. But Pauline kind of realized that if she didn't keep Pam's as a friend, she might have her as an enemy. And that's something that she didn't want. And fun fact I learned in this book, women couldn't wear trousers in court at this time. So so in the late 1960s, women had to wear dresses in court.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. One day when the Beatles were in town, Pam's said, "So what do you think?" Pam went on. The refrigerator door slammed with a dull clunk. "About what?" "The Beatles. Shall I invite the fuckers over?" Mm-hmm. Frank slapped the Frankenfurter between two slices of bread, already lying cut on the breadboard and probably stale. He found some mustard in the cupboard and squirted all over. "First of all, I have a stack of work to get through. And second, if you girls need to wet your underpants, they can come by any time. They know where we live." Pauline's everyday routine was pretty awesome. She'd get up around 11, eat toast with grapefruit, walk down to the Laurel Canyon path to get her mail, read letters from home, separate the mail for Frank and Gail, and so on. And she was beginning to have some issues with Gail because Gail was really keeping an eye on her, really getting into her business. Like they would fight over who would sort the mail. She was finding that Pam's had a heaviness to her, which was hard to live with. Mm. And even though she had squabbles with Gail, she found Gail a little bit easier to live with, but she did use the name scallywag, manipulator, and interfering busybody in talking about Gail.
Wow. It must be weird being a wife, a new wife especially, and a mother, and like you're trying to figure out your role as in this new family, and then you have all these other women like taking roles that normally, you know, would be yours. And I mean, that must have been like a really weird space
for sure.
Yeah,
I wish Gail could have written a book.
I know
Frank wanted her to. And she said she was too busy with like the kids and stuff. So despite all the squabbles, she loved living there, and when she wrote home, she told them that there was no place that she would rather be. She even talks about having no interest in going out on dates or finding a boyfriend because she was too involved in her job and decorating her room.
Wow.
Yeah. She loved her relaxed and easy lifestyle, chose her work hours, but she was useless in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And because Gail wasn't cooking for her, she pretty much needed to teach herself how to eat or how to cook. Because when she was younger, she had been banished from the kitchen by her five older sisters. Mm. But she was taught at the log cabin how to fry an egg. So she learned how to do that for herself.
Baby steps.
Yeah. She hadn't spent any alone time with Frank and ended up on a work routine with him that kept her up all night and then sleeping all day. And in terms of Frank's eating patterns and just like weird routines, I thought it was interesting to note that he never, ever spent time in the kitchen and always ate alone.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. He could always be found, as Pauline writes, hunched at his desk, or he'd shift across to the piano bench, contort one bare foot over his knee, a cup of coffee by his side, a cigarette burning in the ashtray, and start tinkling the keys.
Hmm.
Yeah, she loved to sit on the steps outside of her room and just like watch him make music.
Yeah.
She talks about how the Mothers of Invention came by and how Frank ended up becoming their leader. Like, you know, how he composed songs. So, like, if you want more information about, like, the band and his relationship with the band and the squabbles that were going on with them and their issues, like, read the book. For
sure. Awesome. Great.
She continued to attend shows, and the freaks continued to dance on stage. And by this point, we know that it's our girls.
Yeah.
And around this time, she noticed that Frank did have other women around. For example, a young woman named Gemma. She talked about how Calvin, Christine, Gail, Moon, Sandra, Sparky, Pamela, and Lucy would all come over and watch movies. She says that everyone who lived in the house, including Gail, borrowed money from her. Captain Beefheart comes in at this point, a huge man with a band that would fill the kitchen. When she asked him why he chose the name Captain Beefheart, he replied, "Who's Captain Beefheart? Who's Captain Cook? Who's cooking tonight? Who's tight?"
Well, there you go.
As per usual, Pam's tried to get Pauline to date him, and as per usual, Pauline declined. So Calvin was up in his treehouse. Dick and Pam's were out. And so when Christine's friends, Lucy, Sandra, Pamela, and Sparky, bowled in with shrieks of laughter, she writes, "I almost welcomed them in. Frank came through and welcomed them too, his mood visibly lifting. They were dressed in 1930s gear, white complexions, eyebrows painted like Marlene Dietrich?
Dietrich.
Thank you.
Marlena,
thanks. I obviously don't know who that is.
Old Hollywood.
You are much more cultured in old Hollywood than I am. Dark red lipstick, slinky pink satin gowns, and smooth hair rolled at the ends. They looked so stunning, I just did not recognize them. Calvin dived around taking photographs, and they fell into poses like professional models. Frank even went so far as to invite them to dance again at the Mother's concert in Anaheim on Saturday. Grudgingly, I had to admit that they had a certain panache, an infectious joie de vivre." Yeah. So Frank talked about groupies in his article for Life magazine that he was commissioned to write, and he said, "Girls who devote their lives to pop music are one of the most beautiful products of the sexual revolution."
Damn straight.
And so was the birth of the GTO.
Yes.
And just for a refresher, we'll let everyone know that we have a beautiful special relationship with Pamela DeBar, yes, who is an original member of the GTOs, which is like so amazing. I can't even believe it.
I know.
It's, yeah.
I know.
So I'll tell you about, and our listeners, they don't know, how the GTOs came to be. During Frank and the Mother's concert in Anaheim, the girls arrived dressed up as babies with plastic bibs and diapers, sucking on lollipops and their hair in pigtails. They originally called themselves the Laurel Canyon Ballet Company, and it was Lucy who was the one that recommended the GTO name, Girls Together Outrageously, which could also be substituted for Girls Together Only, Girls Together Often, Outlandishly, although Pauline has suggested to Ian, who is a member of the Mother's band, Girls Together Off-Puttingly. She was coming around to liking the girls, though, and says that maybe she did judge them too harshly at first and that she should break out of my English straitjacket and be more tolerant.
Yeah, you should.
But the girls actually weren't allowed to perform that night because once the Anaheim official saw Pamela's nipple peeking out from under her bib, they would not let them on stage.
Miss P!
Fuck, I love her.
I know.
What Christine would say about the other girls and herself is super interesting. So getting to know the other GTOs from Pauline's perspective was really interesting. I loved it. She talks about hitchhiking to the laundromat with Christine pre-Manson murders, when she says Hollywood was a trusting community. She says that Christine's life centered around her girlfriends. She told Pauline, "We talk about groups a lot." So when the girls are together, they talk about groups. And that's how they became groupies.
Yeah.
These are the girls who, like, coined the term.
Yeah.
They are the original groupies. So Christine says, if you have a rave in a band, it's like having a soldier in the war. You write him letters and you worry about him. Mercy and I send the Velvet Underground a dozen roses with our pictures on the back. You can't be subtle.
You know, Miss Christine ended up marrying John Cale from the Velvet Underground.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
And Christine was actually a model on the cover of Frank's album Hot Rats.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's on the cover. Christine hid her body under layers of clothes, though, because she did have a crooked spine.
Oh.
And she suffered, like, years of painful treatment to try to correct it, which involved being in a body cast for almost 10 months. So I learned this from Pauline's book.
Yeah.
And I think that you know this, but unfortunately, years later, Christine eventually overdosed on heroin at the age of 22.
Yeah.
But before that, Pauline was taking care of Frank's fan club, and she mentions who his, like, typical mother's fan is.
Mm-hmm.
And you might be surprised, maybe not. Frank said that a typical mother's fan is a boy, 18 years old, has acne, is Jewish, comes from Long Island or its equivalent, and is extremely lonely. He is alienated from his parents, worried about his glands, the war, and the draft. Insecure, he needs a friendly big brother image to emulate. Yeah.
And who better?
Mm-hmm. Pauline felt like she was the only one not participating in the sexual revolution because many people thought she was in love with Ian, who is a member of Frank's band, and it didn't really help matters that he slept on a sleeping bag on her floor every single night. She did have an interest in him. However, he had a fiancé in New York, and once again, to reiterate, those guys were off limits to her.
Huh. Okay.
Things were starting to change around the log cabin when one day Frank told Calvin that he and Gail and the family were moving to another home and that they would have to, so they, like he and Pauline, would have to find their own places to live. He would compensate their salary to so that they could afford it, and Pauline was to work in Mutt Cohen's building, that's he's Frank Zappa's lawyer, where the offices of Bizarre, you know, so Frank's record label and company were to be set up. Pauline was devastated, and for all of her complaining and about the drama in the log cabin and like shabby, you know, what's it called, just conditions, she loved being close to the action. Like, she loved living at the cabin. So she said that she and Calvin felt like their parents had thrown them out, and she did not want to go on working 9 to 5 in an office.
It's interesting how she's, like, repelled in a way by, the people around, yet also, like, loves it and never wants to leave.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a strange balance there.
Okay, so I have a super fun story for you.
Yeah.
Around this time, Frank received two very interesting guests, and
ooh,
it's not an episode if we don't mention Mick Jagger. But he came with Marianne Faithfull. So when all of the people who would like normally stop by like the log cabin, because they didn't have locks on the doors,
yes,
and almost anybody was welcome to stop by, even if Frank didn't know them, he welcomed them in.
Yeah.
And there were more people than usual casually lounging around when they knew that Mick and Marianne were going to arrive. And so this is Pauline's description of the entrance. When we returned, I think she was out seeing a movie, we found the house invaded. News had traveled all around Hollywood that Mick Jagger would visit Frank, and freaks from everywhere had besieged the house. Apparently, when Mick and Marianne Faithfull walked in, 20 people lazed casually in the living room, and although it was not unusual for the house to be overrun, it was unusual for visitors to collect together in one place.
Hmm.
Frank had made no protest. Now, though, they had adjourned to the basement, so they did go somewhere private. Mick Jagger, wearing a white shirt with a deep frill down the front, his brown hair parted in the middle and waving to his shoulders, shook hands with Ian while Marianne kissed him on the cheek and spoke with a bewitching, gravelly voice.
Mm-hmm.
"Awfully good to meet you," she cooed. She had short, blonde, floppy hair and wore a green mini dress. Mick, shorter than I'd expected, or at least I looked down at him, shook my hand. So,
okay.
Mick, Frank, and Marianne all jammed a bit, Marianne on the tambourine, and eventually they all retired to the kitchen where Mick and Marianne finished off a full bottle of scotch that they had brought with them. They talked about the government while Christine and Mercy kind of hung back and watched, just kind of like taking it all in. Obviously, Mercy and Christine wanted to be around.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she said Marianne would stand up, do something like a pirouette or a pose or a dance, and then, like, flop into Mick's lap. I like how she describes their rapport. Throughout their visit, Marianne interspersed with Mick. Like a double act, he spoke, she spoke. He spoke, she spoke. Excited and passionate, vocal and opinionated about things everyone at the log cabin ignored. The music scene, fashion, art. They reminded me of what I missed from England. The lively chatter and dynamic arguments about issues of the day. They talked about Vietnam, and eventually Mick and Marianne were so drunk, this is me talking now, that they fell off his chair and Frank kicked them out. But they didn't even, like, realize that they were being, like, kicked out.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Around this time, Christine introduced Alice Cooper to Frank.
Yes.
And Frank agreed to sign Alice's band at, like, Christine's request. So, Lynx's cat, CK, is just having a field day in here right now.
He wants attention.
He wants attention. As per usual. So she said that Christine and Alice stood holding hand in hand, and they looked like twins from a comic strip, all stretched out in skinny arms and legs.
Yeah.
So the GTOs were telling Pauline about their interview with Playboy magazine, and Marianne came in and invited everyone to Sunset Sound Studios to watch Mick mix the album Beggar's Banquet. And so they all went.
Oh, amazing.
And when they got there, another famous pair of lovers were in the studio.
Keith and Anita?
Yay! Yay! So Frank watched Mick at work. And so this is what Pauline says. Although very soon he was pitching in with suggestions and ideas. Maybe that's why Keith Richards seemed to lose interest. And halfway through and withdrew with his girlfriend, Anita Pallenberg. Anita, very pretty, full fringed, tall and waif-like, seemed more serious than Marianne and sat at the desk adding her own ideas on many of the run-throughs.
Nice.
At other times, she and Marianne chatted to the GTOs, Pamela, Sparky, and Lucy, or they hobnobbed together like close friends, whispering and giggling.
Ugh. To be there. Can you imagine? Ugh. Miss P.
Yeah. Pauline does mention that Marianne was pretty zonked out. And rarely sat still and was even flirting with Frank, but he wasn't interested because apparently, like Pauline, he didn't have interest in people who were, like, in relationships or married or whatever. Yeah. Pauline started to worry about her job at this point because of, like, the move that was going to be happening. Pam's and Gail were put in charge of the fan mail. Mm-hmm. And she was worried about that. She's like, nothing's going to get done. And Pauline was realizing that Frank actually didn't have a desire to write that political book that he told her about before she moved to Laurel Canyon. And Pam's actually told Pauline that Gail was intending on getting her fired. Whether or not that's true, like, Pam's did seem to get off on being the bearer of bad news. Mm. Yeah. Pauline talks about her moods, like, they mimicked the atmosphere of the house. Very topsy-turvy, you know, like, there could be so much bitchiness between a friendly service, backbiting, hostility, but also delightful sessions of mad fun and joy. Mm. I paraphrased there.
Yeah.
Many people at the cabin thought that Pauline came from an upper class family, and she didn't, like, correct them. And she said that she altered her accent slightly to a crisp BBC sound. Yeah. The GTOs were starting to sing at the Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention shows. And while Pauline worried about her job after talking to Herb, Frank told her that he did have another job for her and not to worry. He told Pauline to type up Pamela's diaries.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Frank said about them, "She has a whole stack of them. I've seen a couple and they're pretty racy."
That's amazing that even back then he recognized, like, this is worthwhile. Like, we need to save these. We need.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Frank added some more members to the GTOs to add some, as she says, much needed oomph.
Mm.
She described Pamela as ardent and keen. And I think later on, yeah. Later on, for sure, the most professional of the bunch, our Pamela.
That makes sense.
So this is when Mercy and Cinderella joined.
I just realized it's Cinderella that married John Cale.
Oh, okay. Not Christine.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was the other C.
So now they were seven. Frank told them that he believed that they had real rock and roll potential. He told them to come up with 12 original songs and he would record them. Pam's was worried about this because she was afraid that they would replace her as Susie Cream Cheese. Oh. She told Pauline that they were thieves, lesbians, and junkies.
Wow.
Well, that last part was true for some of them. Cinderella was in love with Tiny Tim. And we get to hear about him a little bit. And what I didn't know is that the girls performed Getting to Know You for him. And he called his manager and tried to steal them away from Frank Zappa.
Wow.
Like, he saw the potential of the GTOs and he wanted to, like, be the one that kind of discovered them. But they stuck with Frank, and voila, the first all-girl rock and roll group was formed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pauline wrote, why, they might even acquire their own groupies. Mm-hmm. How right they have. So Pauline actually got the job to look after the GTOs. And since she had experience teaching models, she was kind of like their road manager and like would help them with their dance routines. And sometimes she said like she felt like their school mistress and she had to get them in line. But she says Frank appointed a professional photographer to take pictures of the girls at the zoo. Feeling unwell, with a muzzy head and drained of all energy after days of excruciating pains in my abdomen, despite taking painkillers, I trailed around the lion and monkey cages while the girls, dressed in their most wacky outfits, struck attitudes that drew as many spectators as the animals. She also continued to work on the fan club, which ended up being called the United Mutations.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Gail talked about her groupie days as well. And Pauline writes, Gail had no inhibitions when talking about her groupie days and the various people she'd had flings with. She thrilled us with stories about Terrence Donovan, the famous English fashion photographer. He made love, she said, like a sergeant major. He issues orders with a loud voice ringing out, right leg up, left arm down, turn to the right, belly side over. Very amusing, as Gail could be. I liked her delight in the comic and absurd. Even her shambolic lifestyle was beginning to grow on me. So Pauline began typing up Pamela's diaries, of which she had 14 of, and then enter Cynthia Plaster Caster because Frank was introduced to her by Eric Clapton.
Jesus, he just gets everywhere.
Yeah. And so he brought Pauline three of Cynthia's diaries to transcribe as well.
Cool.
So Frank really was a visionary. Pauline said, Frank seemed convinced that because of the 60s sexual revolution, an explosion of interest in girls' sexual behavior would follow and a market for their journals would soon open up. Secretly, I felt disappointed in Frank. What could I learn from this grubby and tacky stuff? There was something refreshing about their uninhibited voices, their willingness to express whatever came into their heads. All the American girls I'd met, Gail, Pam's, and the GTOs, as well as Cynthia and her diaries and the girls in New York, all of them had this wonderfully free voice, and I wanted it true. I wanted it too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had thought they were irrelevant, inconsequential, the dregs of society, but now, as they'd seeped into my consciousness, in comparison with their spontaneous, unbridled flair, I felt rigid, taut, and unmovable.
Wow.
Yeah. So she talks about warming up to Mercy and as she did with all of the other girls. And Frank was the one who handed the telephone from when he was talking to Cynthia on the phone to Pamela. And that's when Pamela and Cynthia striked up like a great friendship. Yeah. And they struck up like this passion for Noel Redding that they both loved. The GTOs gave Frank their lyrics and he laughed at them, called them inspiring. Meanwhile, like Pauline is sitting here watching all of this and documenting it all, you know?
Yeah.
Which is so cool. Like he had an actual secretary documenting all this stuff. And it's funny because my cousin asked me the other day, like, why would Frank Zappa need a secretary?
Like so many reasons.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Mercy sang her song Shock Treatment. You know, Pauline talks about Pamela taking drama classes, dances, working at the candy store. And she says she admired her energy and drive. And with her beautiful angelic face and blonde tresses would surely succeed. Mm. Yeah. Originally, Frank wanted to publish Pamela and Cynthia's diaries together, but Pamela didn't want that.
Smart.
Yeah. Obviously, because her book,
I'm
with the band, Confessions of a Groupie, went on to become a bestseller and like remains to be like one of the best rock and roll books of all time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One thing that I will say that I found was super cute was one time she walked into the kitchen, into the log cabin, and found David Gilmour and Richard Wright flirtatiously enticing Cinderella, Pamela, and Sparky into the night.
Aww.
So, going back to finding Pauline a place to live, she had three offers from guys she knew. Ian, from the Mothers, Neil Reschen, a hotshot businessman, as she calls him, and Mutt, the lawyer, who had tons of animals. Hmm. They all said she could live rent-free. they all kind of had their stipulations. Like, I think maybe one of them had like a sexual connotation, you know, with Ian and his girlfriend. She thought maybe that wasn't a good idea. She eventually accepted Mutt's offer, where she had her own room on Woodrow Wilson Drive, like half a mile from where Frank and Gail's new house was. Mm. Plus, it had a swimming pool. She said she dreaded the day on September 6th, 1968. She was answering fan mail and the desk was literally taken out from under her and she had to move out. She says, in September 1968, the Mothers of Invention left for a 5-week European tour. And while they were gone, I splunged into mothering the GTOs, those wacky girls who never ceased to amaze, amuse, and surprise me. Frank had been right and I had been wrong. Whereas before I had seen a disheveled, immoral bunch, now when they swore like troopers, fell into squabbles with each other, or confessed that they were too stoned to work, I would shake my head and smile indulgently. I learned that, just as Christine had said, so Pamela and Sparky at 19 were still virgins, though that would soon change. Christine led a life of sexual abstinence. Lucy had a camp boyfriend who dressed like Beau Brummel, while Cinderella still hung out with Tiny Tim, who did not believe in sex before marriage. Even Mercy, for all her flamboyance and eyes like a raccoon, did not attempt to attract boys. Only Sandra, who looked 12 years old, with her small cameo face, showed any sexual appetite.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad that she's, you know, realizing it. And especially realizing it while still in it and not like, you know, decades later, like, why was I like this?
Yeah. She was beginning to enjoy going out with the girls. Everyone would pay them attention. And even Sammy Davis once asked them if they were professionals. So, like, you know, there's so, like, the book goes on and there's so many chapters about the GTOs, their lyrics about Captain Beefheart, pubescent love, groupie life. It was honestly such a lovely surprise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, Pauline really asks herself how she could have originally criticized them as they were showing burgeoning talent and impressive effort. Aww. Yeah. So Pauline had them practicing their dance, and on December 5th, the girls took the stage at the Shrine Exposition Hall. She was very pleased when it was time to sing Eureka Garbage Lady that they all got the lyrics right. They got whoops and cheers. And in the studio, when it was time to record, Nicky Hopkins and Rod Stewart showed up. Rod was virtually an unknown then, but they had the girls excited.
Yeah.
It was Mercy who came up with the title of their album, Permanent Damage, and the girls' reputation was really starting to grow around Hollywood, and it was around this time that the girls did their famous photo shoot for Rolling Stone magazine. Mercy, of course, is on the cover. The girls have their spreads, and at the photo shoot, Pauline ran into George Harrison and Patty Boyd and asked him, "Have you heard of the GTOs?" And he said, "I've heard rumors." So for work, she was typing up Pamela's now 30 diaries and Cynthia's 10, or the script for Frank's film Uncle Meat, and working until like 3 a.m. She'd then hang out with Gail and everyone at the house and was welcomed by Gail into their new home as if she was one of her own.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I think that the relationship actually got better once she moved out.
No doubt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, she shared Thanksgiving with them, Christmases, and by the start of 1969, she wrote home that she was perfectly happy. Aww. She really did adore Frank, and she really felt part of the family. She said, "No longer looking in, I was in."
Beautiful.
Yeah. Gail was pregnant again, and around this time, Christine, Mercy, and Cinderella were found with syringes, heroin, and cocaine and taken to jail.
Hmm.
Frank immediately canceled their contract and stopped any work on their album.
Wow.
She says that journalists were beginning to acknowledge Frank as a unique figure in the music scene, a composer and a songwriter who pushed the boundaries of what was musically acceptable. Like, you know, they always talked about him like he was a weirdo, but they were really beginning to see him for the genius that he was, serious, quiet, and intelligent. And you know how old Frank was at this time?
No.
28.
Oh my God.
I know.
Wow.
Wow. Pauline got her green card, and Frank got over his anger with the girls and called Pamela and Sparky back to the studio to finish the recording on Permanent Damage. This is pretty funny. She says that Pamela and Sparky considered themselves the Lennon and McCartney of the GTOs. Pamela, I love you so much. So 7 GTOs actually went down to 4. Sandra was having a baby. Sparky left, but they kept on.
Mm-hmm.
Atmosphere in the canyon really did change because Sharon Tate's murder, you know, that did happen less than 5 miles away from where they lived. Romance did eventually come calling for Pauline when she met a man named Fred Wolf at a barbecue at her and Mutt's house. She was now being courted by a film producer, rich and celebrated in Hollywood. She said that the next 2 months were full of romance because she always told Frank that, like, he was all about lust and she always needed a connection. She wanted to be in love, really, if she was going to be in a relationship. So they went along Sunset Boulevard to the Pacific Ocean. This guy kind of ended up being, I think, emotionally, like, pretty verbally abusive. Yeah. So they didn't last too long. In November of 1969, she typed up the last of the groupie papers, which Pamela's diaries ended up being called, which ended up being like 900 pages.
Wow.
When she visited England, her friends treated her like a mini celebrity. She says, while my friends married and had babies, commuted each day to humdrum jobs, I lived in the heart of Laurel Canyon, the most happening rock and roll caveat in the world. Wasn't that glamour for you? I thought it was. Yet after the initial euphoria had worn off, my friend's true feelings began to emerge. Pat, the proud mother of Polly, her first baby, said, it wouldn't suit me to travel so much. I need roots. I need to be settled. A veiled attempt to reset the balance.
I hate it when people do that. Like, let people have what they want. You know, you don't need to make negative comments.
Yeah. But, like, man, jealous. Like,
I know. Yeah. I mean, you're really showing your cards when you do that.
Yeah. She talks about Gail possibly writing her own book, as I mentioned before. Frank wanted her to write a book about, like, his groupies, but she never did. She talked about meeting Linda Ronstadt, her beauty, and, like, Linda not even knowing how beautiful she was, about Frank being with women on the road. Gail pretty much put up with Frank's relationships, and just as so long as he didn't bring them into the house. So any time he had mentioned, like, wanting a girl, like, one of his girls to move in or to be a part of, like, a kind of a three relationship, Gail really put her foot down.
Yeah.
Or, and sometimes she would even leave, and then he'd be like, okay, I won't do it. Like,
you listen to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you remember Calvin, who I talked about, who kind of lived in that little treehouse?
Yep. The artist?
Yeah. Actually, they got into a bit of a relationship.
Ooh.
Yeah. Pauline got the groupie papers down from 900 to 350 pages, which took her 2 months. It was now 1970, and Frank's new album actually reached number 9 on the charts. Mm. Her relationship with Calvin turned out to be not great. He was kind of a slob, womanizer.
An artist.
And she was spending too much time focusing on him rather than her. And Pauline was kind of involved in a revolution of her own at this time, because, like, women's lib was really big. So she writes, in America, photographs of women marching in the streets dominated the headlines. They came charging off the front page, braless, chests thrust forwards, fat, thin, short, tall, well-heeled, and downtrodden, all with one resolve: to end men's oppression of women. Love me less, respect me more, their banners railed. Of course, why hadn't I thought of it before? It was not love women needed from men, but respect. Equal pay for equal work. I bought Kate Millett's book, Sexual Politics, and devoured her argument in all 300 pages. The patriarchal system that exists throughout the world, she said, maintains its hold by passing itself off as nature. The natural order of things is for men to dominate and for women to submit. Her book set out to deconstruct that view and argued that women must collectively rebel. Kate Millett, along with other visionaries, had opened the creaky door to women's liberation.
Yes, we still need to band together and fight that. Yeah,
we're still the girls together outrageously often. Yeah, they were really onto something, man. Girls together.
I know, right?
They were so on it. At one concert, she says, she was talking to a guy named Jay about a groupie named Lixie.
Ooh.
Yeah. Jay said, I feel sorry for her. Last night she was with Tony, the night before with Fred, and tonight she's with Jim. He shook his head despondently. I jumped to her defense and surprised myself. Why do you feel sorry for her? She's doing the same as Tony. Every night he's with a different chick and you say he scores. Yo-ho for Tony.
Yeah.
But Lixie, you feel sorry for? Why? How do you know she isn't having a good time too? Why is she spoken of in derogatory terms?
Yeah. Why isn't that her decision?
Yeah.
What? Like, go Lixie.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Go Lixie, go. She continued to work for Frank, but there wasn't as much work as before. She became more of a surrogate nanny and friend to the Zappas at this point. Mm. She was typing the script for 200 Motels, Frank's film. Pamela was in that.
Yeah.
And she was asked to work on the production. She talks about Keith Moon and Ringo Starr being on set and really just how odd and weird the whole movie was.
Yeah.
She felt like the Zappas were really taking up a lot of her time and energy, and so she decided to do some things for herself, like go out and meet new people, read books, like
expand
how to meet friends and influence people or whatever the book's yeah. called, and start questioning the meaning of life.
Finally getting out of the British
yeah.
stuffiness.
Mm-hmm. And the idea of going back to university to do a course in journalism ran through her mind. Actually, at this time, she was recommended to go interview as Mick Jagger's secretary because the Rolling Stones secretary was thinking about retiring. So she went to the south of France to have an interview with him. So they kind of talk about that first meeting that they had. Mm-hmm. The Rolling Stones secretary ended up staying with them after all. So not that she didn't get the job. It's just that, like,
it didn't
nobody
work out.
Got the yeah. job. She was also asked to type up Noel Redding's diaries, but it's not like they were like Pamela's. Mm-mm. They were more like, went to gig, went down a bomb, Hendrix did a moody, may have the clap.
I think he did write a book, though. I haven't read it, though, so that's not the best. That does not make me want to read.
She said to Frank about her trip to the south of France, I went to Keith Richards' huge ramshackle mansion first, right on the Mediterranean at Camp Farret. Anita, his wife, kept complaining about him being away on long tours and how they never had a holiday together. She was really fed up. She wants them to tour anonymously in small clubs all over Europe.
Okay.
Yeah. So Pauline went back to England in 1972 and she had surgery on her ears, which had like really bugged her for years. She had a really hard time hearing. Mm. Her vision was starting to get kind of messed up. Frank was in the hospital for a while. Something had happened with a fan at a show.
Yikes.
Yeah, I'm just, like, breezing by it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, so she ended up, like, staying in England, finished typing Noel's diaries, and took up some secretarial work on the side. And of Frank, Pauline says, years later, I interviewed Frank in London and challenged him. On some points, he was staying at the Hyde Park Hotel and made a lonely figure in the immersed, dour sitting room decorated in dull, muted colors. It was 17 April 1988, a few weeks before he disbanded his last band, over a contentious issue, and 5 years before he died of prostate cancer at the age of 53. He'd survived 20 years in the music business and produced 50 albums, an extraordinary compilation of social commentary, satire, doo-wop, jazz, and progressive orchestrations, several of the albums reaching the top half of the American charts. He'd received 6 Grammy nominations, a Grammy for Jazz from Hell, and another for Best Rock Instrumental Performance on Sofa. All the while, no one had played his records on the radio, and yet over 20 years he sold enough records to make him a rich man. In Europe and across America, they both reviled and revered him. Even John Lennon, when he visited Frank, had been deferential. I may be popular, but he is the real thing.
Wow.
Pauline decided to stay in England and to start building an identity of her own that wasn't linked or attached to Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
Because for the longest time, when people found out about her relationship, her with the family, with Frank, it was just always about Frank. It was always about, how did you meet him? Tell me about him. And it was a bit much for her. So over the years, she mentioned his name less and less until after a while, she didn't mention his name at all.
Yeah.
Gail would send her letters of love, asking her when she was coming back. Aww. And saying, you know, the kids miss you and we love you.
That's so sweet.
Yeah. In closing, yeah. We'll say, she says, it had been my good fortune to meet Frank Zappa on that fateful day in August 1967, and I had reaped all the benefits and goodness from that union, its own education of sorts. Now it was time to fly from him just as I'd flown from my own family 5 years earlier. No longer content to be a bit part player in someone else's drama, I wanted to be the heroine in my own show, plow my own furrow, stir my own waves, and paint the future with my own brush.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's so great.
Yeah. So she did go to Cambridge. She did a psychology degree. She married a fellow student. She began teaching. She had a son. And then when her son left home to go to university, it was kind of time to start writing her story and kind of...
And she sort of got to kind of live her dream as a journalist in a way, because she was part of this scene and now she got to write about it. And I guess at the time you don't realize it, but that is an important role. She was there observing, taking everything down, and she had her place there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's me. It's fantastic. That was great.
Okay, good. Yeah. I feel the episodes are getting longer and we just want to add in so much, but it's we can't put everything in that we want to. So,
but in a way, that's good, because hopefully it gives people more incentive to also buy the book.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to read the book. I want to get all those little details in about the GTOs, especially.
Yeah.
And how Zappa worked and everything, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, that was so good.
It was nice to spend time there. You know, when that's the beauty of the book is, you're spending time in Laurel Canyon. Mm-hmm. It's frigging cold outside, but it's you go there and it's you're there.
It's
and
the
for
best.
Our people who are just I just wish that we could go back to that time. It's you know what?
You can.
Pauline Butcher brings you there.
Yeah.
So thanks, Pauline. And hopefully, we're going to try to find her. And
For sure.
Maybe we'll get a hold of her one
Taylor.
Of these days.
Yeah.
And once Taylor finds the article that she wrote, she said she's going to send it to us so then we can post it.
Perfect. Yeah. I remember when she, I think that's how I found out about the book, actually.
Oh, wonderful. So thanks, Taylor Doll.
Yeah.
Okay.
This was great.
Okay. That's it. That's all, folks.
Yeah. Thank you for your hard work.
Thank you for leading me to this.
Of course.
And have a great day, everybody. And we'll see you next week.
Yeah. Have fun in New York.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. What if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.